Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. I'm your host, Dr. Dave O'Brien. This episode, we'll be talking about Explore Everything by Dr. Bradley Garrett, which is published by Verso and was published in 2013.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. I'm your host, Dave O'Brien. And in keeping with the kind of London basis that we've got for New Books in Critical Theory, I'm here with Dr. Bradley Garrett, who is going to talk to us a bit about this book, Explore Everything, which came out, was it a year ago in Verso Press?
It was actually in October. It wasn't too long ago. Although it seems like a bit of a blur, the thing on an insane tour for a couple of months.
And also, actually, we'll sort of come into some of this a bit later. I mean, the book feels like it's been around for a long time because of some of the publicity around your kind of critical project and your sort of work. But anyway, that will come. So to start off with, could you just sort of introduce yourself in terms of your intellectual background, where you're working at the moment, and I guess how you came to write a book called Explore Everything?
Yeah, sure. I am currently working at the University of Oxford in the Technological Natures Research Cluster. I'm a postdoctoral researcher there. My background, strangely, I did my undergraduate degrees in history and anthropology, and then I jumped over to archaeology for my master's. So I guess when I came into my PhD in geography, my interests really were in heritage issues and material history. And so when I came to London, I was interested in doing a project on kind of alternative archaeologies. So one of the things that I constantly encountered as an archaeologist was a frustration that I was being put in a position of authority over other people's heritage. And so I felt the need to disrupt that. So when I began the PhD, the idea was that I was going to find people who were doing kind of populist archaeologies, people who were doing archaeology on their own terms. And I ran into these urban explorers in London. So these explorers were sneaking into what we might consider heritage spaces, like places like Battersea Power Station, right? Places that have an obvious kind of historic value, but they were doing this on their own terms. And essentially, there were three groups that I was going to study, but once I started going out with the urban explorers, my supervisor, Tim Cresswell, he said, "This is incredible, just follow that story wherever it goes." So that was the beginning of my project. And the book that I wrote, Explore Everything, is a four-year ethnographic account of my time with those urban explorers. And I guess, you know, firstly an account of the places we explored, so it's very much a kind of, you know, it is almost like an archaeological report in that sense, you know, very kind of site-specific, location-based reportage of hidden places in the city. But I guess the more important thing for me was the ethnographic angle. You know, who are these urban explorers? Why did they get involved with the practice? And politically, what does it mean to sort of go into these off-limit spaces in the city and to do this kind of guerrilla archaeology, to record these places without permission?
And that's quite a good place to start in the book, actually. But so what is an urban explorer, even before we kind of get into sort of who they are? Because who they are is a fascinating tale that runs throughout the book. But yeah, so what is an urban explorer?
So, essentially, the ethos behind urban exploration is that the city that we live in, the city that many of us, you know, go operate in every day, going to work, going to school, you know, contains spaces which are off limits to us, and that a lot of those spaces, in fact, have been built and maintained with taxpayer money. And so urban explorers feel this kind of, they feel a desire and a need, but also a kind of moral impetus to actually go and explore these spaces and to record them and to share them with people. So there's a sense that there's a kind of collective, collective urban heritage that is being documented by these explorers of hidden spaces. And very often they end up becoming photographers because that's one way that you share those experiences. And it would be really good, actually, to, you know, later maybe we can unpack the photography practice a bit more, because I think that ended up being a really fascinating component of the study.
Yeah, I mean, from the the sort of materiality of the book. It's very rare to get a book that is dealing with kind of critical theoretical questions around cities, spaces, that has got these wonderful full-color photographs in it. Usually, my experience of kind of even kind of geography cities books tend to be quite dour, black and white. I mean, I had a talk to an architect for one of these podcasts who'd done a really interesting book around cities and spaces and places, and the illustrations were, you know, quite interesting, but they're all black and white. And one of the things that kind of shines through from the verso text is how colourful the text
is. Well, I think that was a vital part of the story, and if we actually think about new work in geography going on around non-representational theory, if the book as an artifact couldn't relay the effective capacity of the photography in the way that they can do online, then I think we've got a problem. So I mean, there was actually, you know, there was a theoretical, if you will, reason for making sure that those photos came through in the way they did with this. And I'm really proud of it. And also incredibly pleased with Verso, I have to say. They were so amazing to work with. And they really went out of their way to, I mean, you know, finding the right ink, paper, you know, finding the perfect combination to be able to print the book in the way that they did. And yeah, it's a gorgeous artifact. But, you know, going back to the PhD that this book came out of, you know, that's how I had constructed it from the beginning. The PhD actually had, I think, 200 color images in it. It cost me a fortune to print. But the examiners appreciate it.
Yeah. And it's interesting you mentioned that, because that, I suppose, theoretical question around how do you, you know, do academic disciplines that take seriously questions of non-representational theory, you know, kind of critiques that come from structuralism. I mean, my area is around kind of, I touch on museums, I touch on heritage, and there is that kind of problem of, well, how do you take seriously these theoretical changes if you're just going to produce, you know, a classic 200-page text that is expected to be read in a fairly kind of traditional way?
Sure.
And it's interesting you've got, I guess, the kind of the disciplinary support.
Well, I fought for the disciplinary support. I guess, no, the disciplinary support was there. The institutional support was a bit tricky. But the idea, you know, is I don't have anything against text. I mean, I think that's the first thing to say. It's just that, you know, photography and video and text, they open out ideas in different ways. And what I really wanted to have was the interplay between those things. I wanted to have all of those sort of tensions there, and to be able to tell those stories in different ways, and to have those materials not operate in isolation to each other, or to have one material subservient to the other. So, you know, the photos in my book are not illustrations of the text.
Yeah.
They do powerful work in their own right. And you could strip back all the text, and this could be 130 photo essay, and it would still tell an incredible story. So that was part of the idea. But while I was doing the PhD, I had to lobby Roe Holloway to be able to mark, to get them to mark part of my thesis on, I guess, those more creative or experimental components. And there was a bit of resistance, but obviously, like, you know, places like Goldsmiths, where they have practice-based PhDs, and you know, people in anthropology, for instance, doing visual anthropology projects, that really helped to be able to show them that this has been done before. And even though, you know, the interesting thing about geography is that because we have that background with non-representational theory, I was able to engage with those things in a slightly different way than a visual anthropologist or a visual sociologist would. And that, I guess, has become my sort of second strand of research interest now, which, of course, I was never expecting at the beginning of the project.
What you're saying is so rich and so many kind of points I can bounce off there, but I'm interested in the kind of the transition that really runs through the book from this kind of, I guess, idea about being an urban explorer to then this concept of place hacking. And it's almost the sort of, at least when I was reading the book, I got the sense of your own journey from being a kind of an urban explorer and then incorporating this broader idea of place hacking. So I don't know if you could say a bit about what place hacking is and how that came up from the work.
Yeah, it was an interesting process. When I when I met the Urban Explorers, I was interested, because of my background in archaeology, I was interested in these issues of heritage. And so that probably led me to meet explorers who were also interested in those things. So we were going in, initially we were going into trespassing into places like Battersea Power Station, Millennium Mills, abandoned hospitals around London. And it was an incredible experience to have this very kind of visceral connection to the history of these places. You know, to go into an abandoned hospital, for instance, and to dig through patient records and to, you know, look through files and to, you know, sit in padded rooms, you know, these places that had been, you know, very often sort of rapidly vacated.
Yeah.
And there were these kind of lingering, you know, essences in the place, which, you know, non-representational theory was all about. It worked really well as a framework for kind of going into these places and trying to kind of relay the effective qualities of actually being in that architecture. But what happened over time is that, you know, as with any good ethnography, is it started to change. And the explorers that I was going out with, they soon started sneaking into construction sites.
Mm.
And I remember having this one really interesting conversation where I was saying to one of the explorers, like, why are we doing this? Why are we sneaking into a construction site? What does this have to do with, you know, the history of the city and heritage issues? And he said, look, Brad, you have to get over that notion that this is about getting in touch with history. He said, you know, the city is a place, it's constantly morphing, it's constantly mutating. And what we're trying to get at is that in-between moment. We're trying to actually experience those moments which are denied to us when architecture is in a state of transition. So, fine, I was sold.
Yeah.
So I go along for these things. And basically, my next challenge then, so the explorers were calling this infiltration rather than urban exploration, right? So my next challenge was, how do I come up with a concept that embodies both of these kinds of explorations, you know, and eventually, as you will find in the book, it sort of, you know, escalates in pace and in danger, and by the end of the book, we're sort of, you know, running two blinds at 2 a.m, you know, dodging trains, going into electricity tunnels, sneaking into bunkers underneath the city, you know, going into sewers where, you know, the possibility for flooding is always likely. And I guess, you know, I thought, how can I possibly relate those things? How can I tie them together? So my idea was that in all of those instances, what we were doing is we were accessing closed space, right? So in the same way that a hacker might try and access a proprietary cyber system, you know, they find a loophole which gets them access to a place. It felt to me like the urban explorers were doing the same thing when they were trying, whether they were trying to gain access to a sewer system or utility tunnel or an abandoned building. It was always about finding that little security loophole and then exploiting it to gain access. And so that's how I came up with the notion of place hacking. Of course, the second part of that is that hacking isn't just about the hack, it's also about sharing the hack.
Yeah.
Because once you do that, it makes it clear to people that A, you gained access, so it's sort of, there's some bragging rights. It's sort of, you know, your credentials as a hacker. You were able to access, you know, some of the most difficult places. But it also gives the forces of authority a chance to then go and seal the security loophole, which I was expecting the authorities to react to you positively. That wasn't necessarily the case.
I mean, at the end of it. It's funny you sort of you say that about the authorities reacting. The book, again, unlike any sort of academic work I'm used to, aside from, I guess, kind of stuff that, you know, does have these kind of, you know, ethnographies of protest and stuff like that, the book opens with you being arrested, you know, and it's very much a kind of an immediately, I guess, kind of, you know, a very real sense of what the risks and what the dangers are. And I've got some questions about that, because there seems to be the kind of the dark side of the photographic method was that the photographs became, you know, evidence quite quickly against you, and equally, you know, the kind of the downside to the, you know, really brilliant kind of display through things like social media and blogging and the kind of community that got built using these kind of digital extending tools was something that the authorities could say, well, we know you've done this because it's here. So I guess, could you tell me a bit, I suppose, the story of maybe the story of the arrest, actually, you know, going, yeah, being on the plane, and take me through that.
Right, so, not to spoil the end of the book, but by the end, by the end of the book, we one of the goals was to access all of the abandoned stations inside the tube, the abandoned,
which is a very emotional moment in the book, actually, around kind of, I mean, yeah, in the script, spoilers, I won't say what happens, but you are presented with this very serious dilemma about what to do around that. And, yeah, it's really interesting how you negotiate that moment, actually.
Well, it's, you know, I was negotiating that, and as it turns out, the British Transport Police were also negotiating that, because they were, they knew that we were gaining access to all of these stations, and they were basically following us as we explored 14 of these stations, and they were, we now know, in hindsight, actually trying to head us off and catch us in the act, because, the thing, we, the explorers, knew that there was a 6-month statute of limitations on criminal trespass on the railways. And so what they were doing was going exploring these places and then letting the photos sit for 6 months and then publishing them so that they couldn't be prosecuted. Essentially, well, we got to all of the stations. There was no one person who saw all of the stations, which is another interesting aspect of this, that, you know, urban exploration is always about the collective ambition and the collective accomplishment rather than the accomplishments of individuals. And that's also where the irony is in the fact that the police then took all of that information that we had and they pinned it on the most vocal of the group, who was me, of course, yeah. You know, because I was out there. Obviously, you know, ethically, I had to be completely transparent about who I was, what I was doing. I was writing academic articles about our work. I was blogging about it. I was very easy to find.
Yeah, yeah.
So the police made the decision that when I left the country in August 2012. I left the country to do a research project in Cambodia, and they decided that when my plane landed at Heathrow, they were going to arrest me on the plane. Basically, they arrested me to get access to my research materials, which opens up a whole other realm of discussion about, you know, what sort of shielding academics should have, especially when, you know, we've signed ethics agreements to protect our project participants and to anonymize data, to encrypt data, and to delete data when we're done with it. And all of this was undermined by my arrest. The police spent 8 months looking through my property, and they didn't find what they were looking for. They were hoping there was going to be some sort of, you know, smoking gun that would show that we were involved in criminal damage or burglary or something, and there wasn't. But they did end up...
I mean, that's very much not the point of urban exploration, you know, at all.
No, not at all. I mean, I was, you know, urban exploration is, you know, it's worth saying this very clearly. It is about reverence for these places. It is about exploring these places and recording them and sharing them. You know, people like to make connections to graffiti because, I mean, and there are obvious overlaps in the way that they're gaining access to different kinds of spaces, and there's something slightly subversive about it, but, you know, the point of graffiti is to do damage.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know...
Thank you.
You can understand how people make the connections between the two, but where the graffiti artist is leaving their tag as a sort of notice that they were there, the urban explorer is taking the photo, which is obviously much less damaging. However, the authorities tend to treat it about the same way,
which
frustratingly.
I mean, that reverence thing is really interesting because it shines through in all of the discussions of the spaces. And, you know, one of the things to comment about the book is it's a global book as well. You know, you effectively go on a kind of mini-world tour. And, I mean, you might disagree, but I kind of got a sense of like you having awe for a lot of the places, you know, particularly when you're doing, you know, those moments that allow you access to the city in a way that you couldn't have access to at all. Yeah. It's a kind of like, and the photographs, you know, obviously, you see some of this, but in the text as well, you get that sense of like wonder that you get.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is the thing, is that trying to capture those experiences was so difficult. You know, when you go into a World War II bunker underneath London,
on the submarine, which is crazy.
Yeah, this abandoned Black Widow Russian submarine that we found in the middle of a river, and we had to take a dinghy out to. You know, you go into these places, and it really is. It's difficult to process the idea that you're standing in a place that 99% of Londoners will never see. They'll never have access to. And then, when you're in a place like an abandoned tube station, and you sort of, you know, you look at the tiling on the walls, and you realize that this place has been closed down since 1946, and you run your finger through the dust, and it comes away on your finger, and you think, wow, has that been building up this entire time, and I'm the first person to touch that. You know, it's... it goes beyond reverence, and it goes beyond documentation, and that's why the photographs ultimately fail, and the stories fail. I mean, it's impossible to relay the depth of the experience. And I think that's why it was so important to me that I tried to use different type of media to kind of get it across. And I think, you know, it was effective to a degree, but, you know, the critical edge of urban exploration here is that it's never about if urban exploration, if all it does is to create media so that people can stay at home and look at it, then it's failed, right? What urban exploration should do at its best is inspire people to get out and engage with the city themselves. And that doesn't mean people are going to be, you know, sneaking into abandoned tube stations, but just that, you know, that those explorations and those stories will act as a prompt for people to get out and experience the city in a different way.
So it suggests a very different meaning to the idea of the kind of the creative city, which has been very big in policy. And I mean, we're doing this interview sort of 15 minutes walk away from Tech City, which is a kind of new media, emerging tech hub. And obviously London likes to talk about itself as being a creative city, which is usually code for new media workers who are often precarious, very poorly paid, this kind of thing. And it's very little to do with how the city's space is used. And the idea of a creative city is very different in your book.
Yeah, and it's very interesting, the conversations that I've had with Marxist scholars, because they tend to identify with those aspects of my book, which I guess look to be somewhat anti-capitalist, and actually they're not. Because as I write in the book, you know, urban explorers are actually very much celebrating capitalism in the way that they're exploring, you know, exploring the Shard, for instance, you know. And so that, you know, but they're exploiting those capital investments, and they're turning them on their heads in a way, because they're actually using space in a way that it was never intended to be used, and using it in a way that's totally unprofitable.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. And I think that's actually where the frustration from authorities comes from, is that urban exploration is a practice which is very difficult to appropriate and to feed into the system. And it is happening now, and it's I think, not in any small part due to my work, which is kind of frustrating, that there's this co-option taking place. But, you know, Marc Auger, the anthropologist, writes about this, it's the extreme flexibility of the global system, which is incredibly adept at appropriating, you know, any declaration of independence, which is the real threat. It's not, you know, the threat doesn't come, I would argue, you know, as Marxist scholars say, I don't think that the threat comes from a direct sort of oppression. You know, it's more from the capitalist co-option of our ideas.
Yeah, and that, I guess, that kind of, that race almost you're in with the kind of the authorities in the broader system, which manifests itself practically in terms of, you know, running away at times, like physically running away, but also that sense of how do we do something new and something interesting. And I think, you know, the kind of the imaginary and the imagination come up quite a bit in the book about how do you imagine the use of spaces differently to what they're being used for. And
it's also about imagining a city that isn't built around economic imperatives. And again, it's not, you know, not to sound anti-capitalist, but, you know, spaces are built and they're designed and they're constructed, you know, to regulate our experiences in a particular way that's always conducive to producing profit, right? And you know, part of what we're saying, I mean, you could relate this to sort of the Cittaslow movement or something. You know, part of what we're doing here is kind of going, let's slow down, let's pay attention, let's reside in some places a little longer, let's try and excavate some of the weird and deep histories that people aren't that interested in. You know, let's take photos of things that, you know, people aren't, you know, let's take photos and produce prints that people aren't going to buy, you know, because these photos are too bizarre.
Yeah.
You know, let's try all these things. I mean, that is the project of Creative Geographies, which is happening right now. You know, I mean, Creative Geographies, Experimental Geographies, Geo-Humanities, however people want to sort of label this project. I mean, it's a fascinating disciplinary shift. I mean, I think it's an actual paradigm shift that's taking place in geography right now. And urban exploration was just, you know, I was lucky to be in the right place at the right time, that it fed into geography at just the time it needed to start this conversation. And I think, you know, in the same way that there was a time and a place for that, there's now a time and a place to sort of move on to the next thing and kind of let urban exploration go.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that was particularly difficult for my project participants, I think, to, you know, because when you do an ethnographic project and you spend years living and working with people, it is quite difficult when you say, but, you know, we've got to move on.
Yeah.
You know? But I think that's what, you know, being honest requires.
And it's interesting that you pose both kind of disciplinary questions for geography, but also questions for university. And I mean, I don't want to dwell on the sort of the arrest and the kind of conflict with the authorities, because that, I mean, I was around in London during the time when this got lots of media attention. And you talk about the media attention in the book and it being, you know, very demanding and also very frustrating, because you were put up as a spokesman and people talk about, you know, you, just you, on your own, when, you know, you're kind of clear in the book that this was a community of people.
Yeah.
You know, it isn't just you.
And it doesn't matter how many times you say that, because, you know, the media isn't used to dealing with the horizontal structure,
no,
as we learned from Occupy.
Yeah, yeah,
right?
Anonymous.
They're incredibly frustrated. All they want is a spokesperson so they can say, this is this person's
view,
right?
Yeah.
They don't know how to deal with the decentralized structure.
Yeah, and all of that, the kind of the challenge to, you know, you as a researcher, and then how you kind of represent yourself, and then kind of try and back away from being just the spokesperson, was something that was quite ambivalently dealt with by the university. And I was really interested in kind of part of the book where you talk about universities having agendas to be kind of public, to be open, to be dealing with social problems and social issues, and yet at the same time, not really knowing how to react when someone does exactly what the universities want them
to
do.
Yeah, and there's this whole narrative now around public engagement and social impact,
and
you know, my project demonstrated all of those things very effectively, but they were also terrified of what was happening because they weren't really equipped to deal with that. But I think more importantly, you know, our first obligation as researchers, and especially as, you know, people who work with other people, is, you know, our project participants should always be our first priority, protecting them, and protecting their wishes for anonymity, protecting their wishes to withdraw from a project if at any point they feel uncomfortable, you know. And that was all taken from me, not just by the police, but also by the media. Once the media had sort of latched onto the story, they were going to run those stories with or without me. And so the decision that I had to make was, do I get up in front of the news cameras and try and control this narrative, as we're told we should be doing anyway, right? Or do I hide and sort of let them do what they will with what I've already published? And my first call was not to my supervisor, appropriately. It was to my project participants.
Yeah.
And I said, how do you feel about this? How do you think I should play this? And everyone said, look, this is what you're trained to do, right? So go and do it. And of course, when I did speak to my supervisor, he agreed. He said, this could be a great thing for your career. It could be a great thing for the university. Let's cautiously work with it. So that was the decision that was made. Whether it was the right decision, we'll never know. I mean, there were certainly a lot of there were certainly negative consequences from the media engagement for me, for Royal Holloway, all of my project participants, you know, everyone has suffered because of this. And, you know, if I could do it all again, yes, I do things differently. On the other hand, you know, I was a PhD student, right? Isn't this what being a student is all about? Learning how to negotiate these things. And I guess, you know, it was frustrating that Royal Holloway seemed to take the view that when the project was over, their responsibility to me was over.
Yeah.
And they didn't, you know, they didn't really offer me any support post-PhD with dealing with any of these things. And I would have appreciated that support.
Yeah.
But I was also very lucky to land on my feet at Oxford.
Yeah.
And they've been incredibly supportive. So.
I mean, to pick up on that point you said about the media, I mean, often, and again, towards the end of the book, you talk about this term, you know, selling out and kind of, you know, the potential critiques around that. But, you know, you're very explicit about how one of the journalists breaking the story said, we're going to run with this whether you want us to or not. You know, and it is, you know, it's not one of those kind of like choices you have, you know, shall I sell the story? Or it was, this is going to happen.
Yeah,
deal with it.
And we knew that, I mean, you know, from precedent, we know that if we were to just let the media run with the story, what they would do is take the most shocking aspects of urban exploration, you know, people climbing on top of buildings, or terrorism angles of people being in vital infrastructure, and they would make that story, right? And so what I wanted to do as a scholar, as a researcher, was to go in and say, look, that's not what this story is about. You know, this is the philosophy. These are the motivations. And they're multiple. There's a horizontal structure here. And there is, you know, a theoretical and philosophical underpinning to this practice that you need to understand. And again, you know, if I had spent 4 years of my life learning those things myself, so of course I felt an impetus to control that media narrative, or at least to, you know, push it in a particular direction, in a direction that was going to be, that would have a bit more depth, and that would you know, pay respect to this community that I had been working with, and make sure that, you know, that all of the work that we had done together, and, you know, this was always very reciprocal. It was, I mean, I was learning as much from them as they were learning from me.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But, you know, making sure that all that work that we had done together and that kind of world that we had built was grounded in the narrative in the right way. And, you know, that worked to a greater and lesser degree, kind of depending on what things you read, of course.
Yeah.
You know, the Daily Mail had their spin on it, and the Guardian had another. But,
no, it's very true. And I wonder, one of the things that comes out is sort of the ambivalence of a lot of these experiences. Just as, you know, different forms of media were kind of, you know, differently supportive or outright hostile. And, you know, you talk about how even the police authorities, whilst, you know, having kind of, you know, fairly oppressive dealings with you, some of them are saying, that's really cool what you're doing, like, you know. And equally with, you know, bits of infrastructure with security guards who, you know, saying to you, yeah, that sounds cool, go on, you know, like, say. And I guess, so I got the sense that from the book, when you dealt with individual people, there was a real kind of interest and sort of hunger for urban exploration and the place having to go on.
I think that comes from the way that cities are being developed now, right? I think everyone feels that kind of existential angst that's coming with, you know, seeing developments go up next to you that you'll never be able to afford, and, you know,
or it's like this even get into.
Yeah, and constantly being you know, pushed further and further from the city and feeling wages go down. And so, I mean, all of these kind of frustrations that are a part of, you know, globalism and living in late capitalist society, you know, those it's not like it's only, you know, young 20-year-old men who are feeling these frustrations. Everyone feels these frustrations. But so when people find a group that sort of gives voice to those frustrations, yeah, of course they lock onto it and they find interest in it. But I guess I think it's, you know, in order to sort of spin this so it's not just negative, it's also the fact that when people see a group of people who are going out to do something creative and interesting and engaging with the city on those sorts of terms, yeah, people are interested in that as well. So we even, yeah, even police sometimes, we got caught on St. George's Wharf in Vauxhall, the skyscraper. It was like, you know, we snuck in, we thought we were fine, we got all the way to the roof, and all of a sudden there were police, you know, surrounding the place. And we went down and, you know, they asked us what we were doing. We said we were photographers, and then I started showing them photos on the camera. And, you know, one of the cops said, "This is incredible. These photos are amazing." And then one of the other officers pulls me aside, and he says, there was a pub across the street, you know, a bunch of people sitting outside drinking or whatever, and he said, "Look, why can't you just go to the pub like normal people?" And I said to him, I said, "Do you honestly think that that's a more productive use of my time?" And I was like, think about on the level of society, like, would you actually rather that I was over there drinking than taking skyline photos of the city and putting them on the internet? And, you know, he sort of turned red for a moment, and he said, "Well, probably not." You know, so, I mean, it's interesting when, you know, we're all subject to forms of control constantly, and very often the most nefarious types of control, you know, in a classic sort of Foucauldian sense, is you know, how we regulate each other, right? And we do it unconsciously, you know, the way we're all quiet on the tube, or the way we queue up, or whatever. And, you know, it very often those boundaries and barriers are totally invisible until someone steps over them, and then all of a sudden, we all can see those barriers for what they are. And I guess, you know, yeah, this project has been quite difficult, and I mean, personally and professionally, and it's been difficult for Royal Holloway, and it's been difficult for my project participants, but through this process, we have made so many invisible barriers visible, and I think that has, you know, the social good of doing that far outweighs anything that we're experiencing. And I think that, you know, if we're going to live in, you know, a democratic society, and if we're going to live in a place where we feel like we have rights and those rights are transparent and we know what we can and can't do and we know where our boundaries are, then it's always going to require people to step over those boundaries.
Yeah, to discover them by stepping over them.
Yeah, to make them clear. So,
I mean, you alluded earlier to the sort of, I guess, that urban exploration being a moment. And what struck me was, and again, from something you said, but also in the text, was the way that it might be the case that that moment has been incorporated. So if you think about like Shard's viewing space that you talk about, which is quite expensive, it's £20 or £30 to go up and see the Shard, or a tour of Chernobyl, which, you know, guides you around the set routes, and, you know, you wear the Geiger counter and this kind of thing. I mean, do you think the question now is, what's the next creative use of a city? What's the next?
That's always the question. It's always the question, because it's really naive to think that there's going to be any sort of social movement that is going to be the answer to these situations, right? And we can talk about the situation. It's how, you know. And this, their answer was always to create something new and something that's disruptive, something that's subversive. In order to do that, you have to keep moving, you know. So urban exploration is, you know, I think is going through a process of co-option right now.
Yeah.
And as I said, I don't think my book or the work that I did helps that process.
So I know. So British Transport Police and the Tube Network are now being much more open about, you can go on tours into the Tube,
sure,
and
yeah,
you can see the kind of the closed spaces that you guys were having to hack into.
Well, the mail rail that you know, we rediscovered in 2010 that had been mothballed for a decade, they're now turning into a ride. So, you know, and some of the World War II bunkers that we had explored, that had been empty, well, essentially since World War II. Those are now being converted into underground farms. People are building houses. I mean, it's not a coincidence that this is happening after, you know, these spaces were explored and shared. Because, you know, I guess we could relate this back to the idea of place hacking. But, you know, once you make that information public and once you make that information visible, people will act on it. You know, So, you know, this is about accessing secret spatial information and sharing it. And once you share it, of course, it's not a secret anymore. And then people are going to start protesting about the way that it's used or you know, rethinking the ways in which these spaces can be used.
So what happens next for you personally then? Have you got another book project?
I think urban exploration for me is sort of it's done. I mean, it's something I'll always come back to. And I guess, you know, in terms of that process of co-option, I'm not sort of mourning what's happening to the community. Because I think it did the work it needed to do at that time. And urban exploration is fragmenting now into a bunch of different communities, which is great. That's what it should do, right? And it's there are going to be new offshoots to this practice that we can't even anticipate.
Yeah.
And you know, that creative drive that the participants have, you know, is always going to cause it to manifest in different ways. So I think, you know, we can look forward to that. But that will be a project for someone else to write about. At the moment, so I've got my second book coming out in September, which is basically going to be a photographic dissection of subterranean London. So I've broken up the city into five subterranean layers. And I guess that book, in a way, it complements Explore Everything in that it's a bit more rich in terms of the photography, or it's a bit more weighted toward the photography rather than the text. But that will come out about the same time as the paperback to Explore Everything. So hopefully those two will sit quite nicely together. So in terms of my ethnographic research, though, I'm going in a totally different direction. I recently found out about a company called Blue Seed. It's a group of Silicon Valley entrepreneurs, and they've just purchased a cruise ship, which they're going to be mooring in international waters outside of San Francisco. And basically their idea is that they're going to subvert the U.S. work visa system by allowing people to come and live and work on the cruise ship in international waters, and then kind of ferry people in for meetings in San Francisco, whatever. So that they're supposed to be launching this ship in July. And I've sent them I sent them a letter. I haven't received a response yet, but I'm very much hoping that my next project will be living on this ship. And
wow.
And again, not just doing the kind of basic journalism work of figuring out who's on the ship, but trying to figure out, you know, what are the philosophical motivations to try and get around? I mean, think about the geopolitical questions of kind of, you know, skirting around international borders and visa systems and what kind, you know. I mean, just in terms of the globalization of work and migration of workers across the world, you know, what kind of effects would this have if everyone kind of starts ignoring visa laws? And
again, I suppose there is a through line in that sense of, you know, you're showing where the state is and how the state exists by finding its boundaries and testing them.
And also that work can be traced right back to the beginning of my career, because if you think about what an archaeologist is doing, right? I mean, they're excavating the hidden, right? And what happens when you sort of, you know, go through that actual physical process of digging things up is that certain things become visible, things that weren't necessarily visible before. And then you can start thinking through what those things mean, you know. And so, you know, I feel like for me the sort of materiality of space is always the opening question. But the more interesting question is, you know, what's behind it all, you know, thinking about human behavior, the way that we construct society and the way that we construct situations, and how that is, you know, very often reflected in architecture, in art, in urban life, you know, and that's what I'm interested in digging into further.
Cool. We'll keep digging. Oh, that's really great. Thanks very much.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you've been listening to New Books in Critical Theory. Thanks very much for listening to our discussion with Dr. Bradley Garrett about Explore Everything.